Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast that's considerably more reliable than a constitutional right in the state of New Mexico. I am Matt Welch, joined by the Roundtable A-Team. That's right. You heard it. You heard it correctly. Sorry. Peter Zuderman, Catherine Mankiw Ward, and the triumphantly returned, grunting, and newly betrothed Nick Gillespie. Salutations, everyone.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Nick, I think I speak for everyone in the listener-aville, which is to say that I hope that your shirt is back on, but also but also that you should be touched by the surprising, at least to me, number of people, listeners to this very podcast, who were concerned about your whereabouts during the Mudfest. They were hoping...
I think that they were afraid that I would come back, though.
I know.
That's my hermeneutics of suspicion reading.
If only they could see your mustache.
No, it's very touching.
They should know how...
Oh, they will. They will.
How horrible it is. I know you're going to talk about Burning Man later. I don't want to spoil the fun, but can you at least tell, for those people who are particularly concerned about your escape from the mud pit, how did you get out? Did you hitch a ride with Chris Rock? How did you leave?
No, you know, I gave up because I had a very strong Day of the Music Died vibe in that Jeep that him and Diplo was in. So I was like, hey, I'm going to be Waylon Jennings. Chris Rock, take my slot in that rickety airplane. No, there was no crisis. We'll get to this later.
Okay.
And I drove out, I got out the way I came in a U-Haul rental van.
All right. Let's get on to the business at hand. Which is that last week, an important American politician warned that masses of newly arrived migrants from south of the Mexican border are threatening to destroy, his words, whole swaths of America. This politician was not former President Donald Trump, nor Trump's mini-me, Vivek Ramaswamy, though the latter did last week threaten to deport legal resident children of illegal immigrant parents. No, I am talking here about the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, Democrat, last time I looked. The five boroughs where Nick and I both live have seen over the past year and a half an estimated 100,000 asylum-seeking migrants, initially mostly from Venezuela, but increasingly from Africa, including 21,000 kids who showed up to school for the first time last week. Adams has blamed the influx on Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who did send some buses from the border to the Big Apple, but that's just a fraction of the overall traffic. It's come from other places, including El Paso, which is run by a Democrat, and even Colorado at some point, although I think they've stopped those. New York, fairly unusually for an American city, has a longstanding right to shelter law, meaning human beings without a place to sleep, have a legal right to a bed in a homeless shelter. Those shelters are now officially over capacity with more than 110,000 occupants, half of whom are estimated to be migrants. The city has been commandeering hotel beds. We are now seeing the unusual for New York site of tent encampments. There have been protests kicking up all over town, especially Staten Island, but not only. Every time an existing public facility like a park or a tennis court or a school is used to process these migrants. Asylum applications can take years to process. The moment you get your application messed up, which is not hard, you can then become an illegal immigrant. There's estimates that as many as half of the people here are already in that status. Applicants are barred by law from obtaining a work permit in the first 180 days after applying, which is a rule that Mayor Adams and the Biden administration increasingly is trying to speed up. And obviously, this is not just a New York story. There are similar, if less numerous, scenes playing out in Chicago and Philadelphia and El Paso and obviously a whole bunch of border towns in Texas, especially in New York State. More than 80% of residents say this is a big old problem. And now Mayor Adams is threatening across the board 5% cuts in every government agency as the city faces a budget deficit larger than the GDP annual of some small countries. Catherine, long wind up. Sorry for that. But it's a complicated problem with any number of governmental fingerprints on the murder weapon. You libertarians, Catherine, Loved to talk about the dispersed benefits of immigration, but we are staring down the barrel of some concentrated costs. I am going to give you the magic wand, as I like to do, to change one policy, not the initial rule for coming in. But what do you do after? You are the mayor, you are the governor, you're the president. The town is a mess. What is a policy fix that can make it less messy?
Let immigrants work. That's it. Just let them get jobs. Then they can pay for stuff. And some of that stuff will be like bus tickets somewhere else. Let them work. Let them earn a living. That is what they want to do. Overwhelmingly, this is not like a vibe. This is like a thing that is borne out over and over in surveys. Immigrants want to get jobs, and we make it illegal for them to do so, as you mentioned. The absolute gall of Eric Adams, but also of any politician, to pretend that the budget deficits that they are operating with are the fault somehow of these immigrants. It's shocking. Like, they are saying utterly implausible statements with totally straight faces. Like, these, it's a lot of people. I get it. But these 100,000 people who came here are not why New York can't pay its bills. New York made all those choices a long time ago. That is not the immigrants' fault. And they would be happy to contribute to the tax base right away, I am sure, if we let them work.
Nick, there's a policy phrase, which is unlovely, but it's also descriptive, called catch and release, which is to say, you knock on the door, you're from Venezuela, your country sucks, you're looking for a better life, you apply for asylum, you have a right to do that if you enter a port of entry, knock on the door, I'm here to apply for asylum. They're like, cool, come back in X number of days, you are now released to go about your business. Is that a good policy? Should people be allowed to go about their business anywhere in the country after having just knocked on the door and applied for asylum?
Matt, can I answer that question with the proviso that I get to make an insult about Eric Adams afterwards?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it is a good policy in the sense that the overwhelming majority in the 90% range of people who are given asylum hearings end up showing up for court. So they go out into the country to the extent that this happens, and then they show up where they're supposed to be for their rulings, even when they know that overwhelmingly they're not going to be granted asylum. That's not really the issue here. I mean, Catherine, I think, is onto something huge when saying let people work, whether they're migrants or not. That's a huge thing. There's also people like David Beer and Alex Narasta at the Cato Institute talk a lot about humanitarian parole. We know where the countries from which most of these people are coming. There is a way to set up where they make an arrangement with people in their home country when they come here, where they are allowed to enter the country and live semi-legally, possibly even work and things like that. And that changes the dynamic at any border and whatnot. That humanitarian parole should be expanded. Obviously, we need to fix actual immigration into the country. That's a heavier lift. But the Biden administration, actually, this is one thing that he's generally been good at. The beginning of this year, he expanded humanitarian parole. It needs to be done so even more.
Insult?
In the original edition of Trivial Pursuit, one of the questions was Richard Pryor once described him as a dick with clothes. And he was speaking, of course, of Ronald Reagan. I think we can now transmigrate that to Eric Adams. He is a complete clown as a mayor of New York. Bill de Blasio is terrible. I don't know that anybody will ever get, under Bill de Blasio in terms of just being shitty, since Abe Beame. But Eric Adams is a complete fake and fraud. He lies about being a vegan. He lies about curing all of his illnesses, including his baldness, I think, at last check, from eating vegan diets. He may or may not live in New York City, but he has offered absolutely no solutions to any of the problems in New York other than saying we need more money from the federal government. And that, as somebody who's lived in New York and also lived in Buffalo in the early 90s, where all of the candidates for the mayoral election when I left in 93, their whole platform was, I'm going to get more money from the state. I'm going to get more money from the federal government. I'm going to get more money, you know, from the EU. Eric Adams is a disaster.
I should also add that in the same, it wasn't even a press conference, it was some kind of town hall on the Upper West Side, where he said that the migrants are destroying the city and you won't be able to recognize it. His preamble to that was, you know, I turned the city around in my first X number of months. We totally fixed everything. And then, you know, Greg Abbott ruined it all. And it's just like, I'm trying to think about the one thing that might have been fixed.
The one thing that New York City, or, and I guess it's a state law, I'm not even sure, to be honest, but, you know, there is a right to shelter in New York, which is one of the reasons why New York City has many fewer unhoused homeless people compared to places like San Jose, San Francisco, Oakland, LA. And that is something that probably really needs to change, because it does put a ridiculous, you know, kind of burden on the city ultimately to provide a bunch of stuff. But having said that, if you really believe that 50,000 migrants, because, you know, half of the 100,000 homeless people, blah, 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 are immigrants, supposedly, if, you know, 50,000 or even 100,000 people can bring the greatest city in America and on the world and in the galaxy and blah, 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 a city of over 8 million people to its knees, this city is doing something, everything wrong.
I also want to say at that Upper West Side meeting, Adams said, you asked me a question about migrants. Tell me what role you played. How many of you organized to stop what they're doing to us? Which is such a weird portrait of, like, citizen responsibility. Like, what were the citizens of the Upper West Side supposed to, like, stand at the Port Authority and prevent the buses from showing up? Were they, like, it's not even, and he could have said, like, well, tell me what you're doing to help with this humanitarian crisis. Like, you guys all have these, like, rent stabilized 7-room apartments. Like, you put up some of those guys. But that is not what he said. He said, stop what they're doing to us, which is just such a shocking us versus them formulation, I think.
Well, also, he is, and Peter, well, we will let you talk. He has been in fits and starts throughout this process, been kind. He lacks a certain political skill to cover what he's obviously trying to do. And what he's obviously trying to do is to spread the pain, or to spread the impact of it, particularly in places that well-off people like to relax and enjoy and whatever, so that they will then become politically active to complain to the Biden administration, which will then give him more money, or complain to Kathy Hochul, the governor. And he's transparent about this, and it's bizarre. And also, Catherine, the week before he did this, he convened, Adams did a last-minute rally to show that New Yorkers care about migrants. What are you even doing? Peter, Nick said earlier something that will make, I'm sure, some listeners and certainly some people who don't listen to this podcast pause and do like the little emoji thing, which is to say that, you know, Biden's doing a pretty good job on this. The widespread perception is that there's chaos at the border and that the administration doesn't know what it's doing. What say you about that notion? And then just also, what is a public policy in any part of this that could be improved besides the work permit thing to alleviate or make this a smoother process?
So if you think that the Biden administration is doing a good job at the border, you have to reckon with what they have done to effectively continue Title 42, which was the Trump era immigration policy put in place by, of all agencies, the CDC. In order to, to control the coronavirus pandemic. So that did eventually expire because the emergency did eventually kind of sort of end. But the Biden administration just put in what amounts to a new, slightly less restrictive, slightly less terrible version of Title 42 that still attempts to severely restrict immigration at the border. Now, a judge has said that this actually violates the 1980 law, and this is not legal, you can't do this, these restrictions are not legally kosher. So there's a bunch of legal wrangling over that. But that's what the Biden administration has tried to do, is basically just continue what Trump is doing, but not quite as without quite the same level of tight controls. But for example, it requires folks who want to seek asylum to go online to apply. And there's a couple of problems with that. Most of the people who are trying to seek asylum don't have cell phone access, right? Or at least a lot of them, right? If you are in the midst of a perilous border crossing, it's not like you've got great access to Wi-Fi. The other problem is, even if you do have a phone, the website is, not surprisingly, buggy as hell. One thing that we have learned over the past decade is that the federal government is bad at building websites. And so, you know, if you're going to say the Biden administration is doing a good job, I do think you have to at least kind of think about what they have done with their border policy. In terms of the chaos at the border, some of that, it is true, is not the Biden administration's fault directly. It is the fault of Congress and the longstanding failure of Congress to pass any kind of immigration reform. And this is because there is no agreement within or amongst or between the parties about what to do about immigration. The Republicans just sort of want to shut things down and restrict stuff and then also hammer Democrats for being bad on immigration. And the Democratic position is totally incoherent. It's different from between different people. But what it amounts to, if you take the Democratic Democrats in Congress as a kind of a blob and like average it out, what it amounts to is, well, we want immigrants to be able to come here illegally and not do anything about it. Right. And it's like they that doesn't make any sense. If you want them to be able to come here, then you should pass a law that says it's legal for them to come here. And here's a clear, orderly process that makes sense, because there is not a clear, orderly process that makes sense. And that is the whole problem with immigration, is that we want more immigration and we want better immigration. We want less chaos at the border. And the way to do that is to rationalize the immigration process, make it easy, make it make sense, make it so that people can just go through the system. And when it is easy, when it is straightforward, you will have probably not zero problems with border chaos, but many, many, many fewer problems than we have right now. And I actually think there's a weird way you can think of something like music piracy in this. In the early days of the internet, people spent a lot of time downloading music illegally through stuff like BitTorrent and and Napster, right? And there were all of these other services, Audio Galaxy, right, that you could use. And one of the reasons that people used those services is because there was no legal way to get music easily online. And it's, yes, piracy still exists. The music industry is I don't want to say the music that legal streaming has totally fixed and totally solved the music industry. It's quite complicated. On the other hand, Spotify and Amazon and Apple now offer these services, and they are hugely popular. And a lot of the constant of piracy, of where that was just assumed to be the way that you got your digital music, a lot of that has gone away because there are now easy, straightforward legal options. And that sort of thing is just true all over the policymaking sphere as well. Give people straightforward, easy legal options, and the vast majority of people will take them, and then you can solve the problem issues. The problems become much smaller and much more discreet and solvable because you have a straightforward way for people to immigrate.
But that's also one of the reasons, since January, encounters on the southwest border, the border between the U.S. and Mexico, since January are down every month compared to last year because of humanitarian parole. That can be expanded. That's a success. Overall, more people, immigration encounters are happening, but they're not happening at the southwest border. So things are actually, it's not perfect, but humanitarian parole is a very good policy that actually takes care of, because most of the people who are coming, they might not have a cell phone after they have been ripped off by coyotes and beaten up by thugs along the way, but they do in the countries that they're leaving.
Fair enough. Yeah. You can say the Biden administration has done reasonably well with the tools they have, but The Biden administration also could be leading Congress here and has spent 2 years passing giant laws full of spending for every possible group that that is like in the
including
in the Democratic coalition, and did not prioritize during the time that Democrats controlled both chambers of Congress. Did not at all prioritize immigration reform because Democrats don't know what kind of immigration reform they can or want to support politically.
Catherine, one thing that you hear a lot about locally is the issue of fairness. All right. So people who are not themselves migrants, or at least haven't been this year, will say, wait, how come this guy gets to stay at the Roosevelt Hotel? I don't get to stay at the Roosevelt Hotel. What the hell's going on here? You see this with schools. There is no, as far as I know, vaccination requirements on the 21,000 kids who showed up to school last week in a city where vaccination requirements for the COVID-19 virus, so-called virus.
The mind virus. The woke COVID mind virus.
The woke COVID mind virus were onerous enough so that people who couldn't participate in extracurricular activities if they were 12 years old and didn't take one for a good long while. And now suddenly we don't have any vaccination requirement. How do you address that sense of fairness, which boils people's blood?
Yeah. And of course, there's the ultimate fairness fight about immigration, which is the who did and didn't stand in line debate always looming over all of these conversations. You know, my inclination, which is both unpopular with the American public and perhaps even unhelpful to resolve this specific debate, is like, these people have been through it, man. And it's okay if they get a little extra special treatment. Like, that's kind of my initial instinct, right? And that's not a public policy answer. But I do think like, hey, are you a child who was forced to leave your home country, perhaps because your family was starving and or some of your relatives were imprisoned or persecuted in some way? Like, yeah, like maybe we can skip the flu shot for you right now. And of course, you want to balance that with long-term concerns. I actually don't know if New York has a flu shot mandate. It seems like the sort of thing New York might do. But COVID vaccine, let's say. You know, I think the housing entitlement is more problematic. And Nick is right that that is creating some pretty wackadoodle distortions. But particularly with regard to asylum seeking children, I just feel like, you know, maybe what justice demands is not equality here. That could be an option.
I think Michael Bloomberg, when he was mayor of New York, trying to do a flu shot vaccination requirement for the schools, but was resisted. That's my memory, since I don't recall getting flu shots for my kids.
Matt, are you, I guess your kids are no longer in the public schools.
That is true.
Right?
That is true. So who
knows? Because I was, are you upset that the influx of young girls from Central America means your daughters can't play short fielder in on the softball teams or something? That's why your blood is boiling?
It's worth pointing out that this influx of 21,000 migrants comes against a backdrop of 136,000 people leaving the public school system in the last four
cool.
years.
Now we got some spots. That's, no probs.
Yeah, like the New York Post is, you know, obviously the world's, or at least America's greatest newspaper. Maybe it's a little bit behind the Daily Mail in the world rankings. But, you know, they're like, our already overcrowded schools are now overrun. It's like, wait a second. Pretty sure I've read a lot about how the schools are undercrowding themselves.
Yeah, and to be fair, it could be like our already poorly run schools will suffer to handle as they attempt to handle this quite difficult pedagogical challenge. Like, that's a true sentence.
Yeah.
So it is true, true that kids who are currently enrolled in schools, especially ones that have large, you know, sort of unanticipated immigrant populations, it's not going to necessarily go great for them. That's true. You know, but to that, I kind of just, my temptation is just to go full libertarian and be like, yes, this is why we shouldn't do zoned public school, et cetera, et cetera.
That's super helpful. As usual,
Catherine. All right.
Related.
Said it wasn't helpful. I prefaced it with that.
I know. This is fine. Related topic, again in New York, but it has broader implications, I do believe. Last week, in the very midst of this here migrant housing crunch, the city of New York, in its infinite unwisdom, started banning Airbnb and similar short-term rental services unless the host is on the premises. That's the best way. That's how I like to rent. Like, hi! And there are no more than two guests. This sort of, you can't do this with your property regulation is distressingly common in places I like to live and everywhere else that Democrats and progressives seem to run. And it's stupid. Catherine, can you explain in more eloquent language why that's not a really good public policy idea?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It does really, like, the contrast or the segue between these two topics. It's like, gee, we have all these people, some of whom do have resources, right? Like, not every migrant is impoverished. Not even every asylum seeker is impoverished. Wouldn't it be cool if there was, like, some kind of company that made it really easy for them to, like, just contractually arrange, like, a short-term or like, mid-length stay in a home? Like, that would be so cool. I wish there was a company like that.
Counteroffer, what if there was a bureaucracy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What if it was a joint project of Eric Adams and, like, whichever angry Southern governor wants to be involved? Yeah. I like Airbnb. I know it's, like, uncool to like Airbnb now because they make you change the sheets and, like, there's a lot of fees and stuff. And that's true. And that's annoying. But it fills a genuine need. And as always, the problem is not Airbnb. The problem is New York City housing regulations, which are renowned for being the most bananas in the country. They wrote some of those rules sometime in the middle of World War II, and they were like, yep, going to stick with these. These are killing it. And that's what's going on here, right?
These, you know who else was killing it in World War II?
Stop it. The housing rules also include, all right, the short-term rentals means 30 days or fewer.
Under 30 days.
Thank you. And so if you have 31 days, then they have the right to kind of stay and squat and, like, not pay rent. You can't evict them. Like, you're just screwed in every direction. Peter, you're from Florida. Do all of the New York refugees who flee this kind of crap, do they import their crazy, stupid policy housing ideas? And or if you don't want to answer that question, what's your favorite dumb thing about this?
So I think when they go to Florida to escape bad New York policy, they probably bring a little bit of New York with them. And they probably want to escape the bad policy and therefore don't bring that with them. The best thing about this policy is how incredibly contrived the justification is and what transparent bullshit it is. So here is a sentence from the Washington Post write-up about this. According to city legislators, so this is a summary of what the city legislators have said. The law is intended to, and I'm going to add the numbers here. The law is intended to, one, stamp out illegal short-term rentals. Why? They're illegal because you said they were against the law? There's like not actually, this is not a justification. It doesn't, or it's just like we said hats were illegal and we found out some people were wearing hats.
Stamp
right?
out
like,
illegal
yes,
hats.
Illegal hats, right? It's an illegal hats law. Right. Number two, ensure the safety of guests bunking in private dwellings. And three, ease the tight housing market. So let's start with number three. Number three is they're going to ease the tight housing market by making it much harder to get a place to stay for a couple of weeks. So that's nonsense. And number two, ensure the safety of guests bunking in private dwellings. So one of the provisions of this law is that you can only rent out your house as an Airbnb or Airbnb type thing if the guests have, if you are living in this in the dwelling with the guests, and the guests have access to every part of your house via unlocked doors, with the maybe exception of locking the bathrooms while they're using them.
None of those things are making me feel safe.
Right. So it used to be that, for example, you could have like a separate dwelling with a bunch of lockable doors so that you could be on one side if you were, say, the owner. Or if you were the renter, you could be on one side and have doors locked, right, and separate yourself. And this is going to create safety problems. Like, I guarantee you there will be at least one and possibly a handful of safety incidents that are caused buy this. There is no way that this actually makes anyone safer here. And it's just very obviously kowtowing to the hotel industry, and in particular to the hotel unions. Hotels hate Airbnb. Hotel unions don't like this either, because it makes things more complicated. Like, it's because it takes away some of their business. Eric Adams is a Democrat who likes unions and wants to do their bidding. So the Democrats, you know, who run New York, like, this is, they are very union friendly. The hotel industry is quite powerful. And so now people are going to have to stay in much more expensive, in many cases, much less convenient hotels, and it's going to reduce the number of options that people have. So I'm not actually a fan of Airbnb in general. I like to stay at hotels. I prefer. But when I travel with my dogs, I have to stay at Airbnb because I have very large dogs and I need space, and I need that's the only way to get, say, a yard or just like somewhere where I can put up my dogs for an evening. And that is where Airbnb has had a lot of value for me. And New York is making that effectively impossible.
Nick, now I just want to ban Airbnb just so that Peter can't travel with his 800-pound dogs.
Yeah. So. Well, he can ride them places and then sleep underneath them. It's like Clifford the Big Red Dog. Right?
Sometime not on this podcast, I will tell the story of the time that I rented an Airbnb that was explicitly booked as being haunted, but actually turned out to be owned by an accused assassin and embezzler.
Ooh.
It was good.
Wow. I would like to watch that 8-part miniseries on HBO.
Yeah. I will be making a true crime podcast about my Airbnb stay later on, so stay tuned.
Is that the plot of the next twist on Good Old Murder House?
Yeah, the next Kat Rosenfield novel is just your life story.
The story does involve disappearing in an evening gown and coming back in camo covered in blood.
Wow. But that was you, right? Not the host.
That's a twist.
Matt, I wanted to point out, while all of this Airbnb and the migrants and, you know, New York, you know, sinking because of global warming and everything, there was a story in the New York Times that came out like a couple days ago about a former New York City school teacher who had become a full-time Instagram and TikTok influencer because she was living in her parents, who I think either they definitely moved to Florida, they may already be dead, in a rent-stabilized apartment on the Upper West Side for $1,300 a month. It's like, from the pictures in the New York Times, it was far bigger than your house. It was a 1,200 square foot apartment on the Upper West Side. She was renting for $1,300. And she had gotten so busy as an Instagram influencer that she had rented an office apartment elsewhere, et cetera. And it's like rent control in New York, and it's, or rent stabilization rather, The housing rules for building, for maintaining, for charging market values are so out of whack. And as Catherine was saying, these things go back, you know, to like the second or third Franklin Roosevelt, Fiorella LaGuardia period. And I know how much you hate LaGuardia, Matt, because he's both Jewish and Italian, the two races that you want to eliminate. Things got to change.
I will point out that, speaking of Nick without a shirt on, he and I both spent some quality romantic time together in Havana, Cuba, and on a great recent trip, and with the Right Honorable Jeff Flake. Let's talk about shirts off, Catherine.
Thank you.
And
it's the only way to could pull it off. Yeah,
that is true. Havana has considerably more, at least it did then, I haven't checked recently, more Airbnb opportunities than New York City. So the commies are beating the capitalists at their own game. Shame. All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, what gets you up in the morning or afternoon, whatever, no judgments? What allows you to screw on your pants one leg at a time, just like anybody else? Sometimes it may be a wonder that we still know how to breathe and feed ourselves, but the instrument getting these jobs done, even on our darkest days, is our brain. Now imagine for a second we could make this marvelous organ work better, because we can, you know? This is where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many, many people that I know personally. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, and if you don't like the first one, you can just swap them out for a second. Let therapy be your own guide. to fixing your brain with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, please email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Mark Stoddard. Thanks for the pronunciation guide to your first name there, Mark. who writes, if you could have a modern American hero on a t-shirt, poster, mug, sticker, whatever, who would it be? Example, Matt Hoover being put through the federal machine gun crime ringer for peaceful exercise of First Amendment activity. Edward Snowden could be another. Who are Americans unsung or undersung? And I'm going to parentheticalize here the old Mad Libs word, Nick Gillespie, underslung, which I never knew what that meant. Heroes. Catherine, you go first.
Yeah, I'm going to say the answer is Jeff Bezos, still underrated despite being so highly rated. Just every single day, Jeff Bezos helps me and every other person in my demographic, at least, and I think in a lot of other demographics, keep their shit together. Like, put a bald-headed silhouette on a t-shirt and wear it. I would.
Nick, we put together a 35 Heroes of Freedom for the 35th anniversary of Reason Magazine, from what I remember, which I think was a great success. Who is your hero that you would put on a t-shirt, mug, whatever?
Very quickly, I would put Ross Ulbricht, the founder of the Silk Road, who should be out of prison by now, but won't be for the, you know, probably the rest of his life. I also want to throw in Hamdi Yulakaya, the founder of Chobani Yogurt, an immigrant to the United States who has not only created a whole new mania around yogurt, but has created tons of good jobs for people all over the place. And then finally, because it was the U.S. Open this past weekend, Billie Jean King. I was thinking of the interview that I did with Robert Lipset, the novelist and biographer of various people, including Muhammad Ali, who talked about her as the single biggest sports change agent of the past 50 years or so. I think that's true. She really mainstreamed a lot of different elements in our lives, not least of which athletes getting paid what they are worth in terms of bringing asses into the seats.
When Coco Gauff won the women's singles title at the U.S. Open a couple of days ago, one of the first people that she thanked was Billie Jean King, Billie Jean Moffitt King from Long Beach, California, who grew up with her professional baseball player brother, Randy Moffitt, went to my high school and lived down the street from us. So it's really all about
on Pepper Pot Lane,
Pepperwood,
Peppercorn Lane,
Pepperwood Avenue. It's absolutely not an avenue. Peter, rescue us.
Little racially exclusive bubble.
Untrue. It's just a little bit anti-Semitic at first, but we all get over it. Peter, who's your hero?
Who's my hero? So when I heard this question, I realized, are we looking for like a great American hero, or are we looking for something that's a little more personal and close to us? And I tend to think of these things in very personal terms. Who has inspired me? Who has made my life possible? And so, in a lot of ways, Lanny Friedlander and Nick Gillespie. Right, like I want the Lanny Friedlander and Nick Gillespie statue. But if I want to pick somebody who in some ways sort of if I want to go back historically, like find something else.
Even the pigeons wouldn't crap on those statues, Peter. But thank you very much.
Like people, Lanny and Nick paved the way and made a huge impact on life and liberty in America and in my life specifically. But who else did that? Jerry Thomas. Jerry Thomas was maybe the first star tender, the first star bartender. He wrote the seminal, arguably the first book of cocktails ever published. Jerry Thomas's Bartender's Guide lived in the mid 1800s, and it was when bartenders went back and looked at his book and then other pre-prohibition guides, starting in the 1980s and 1990s, but really kicking off through the early aughts. That cocktails as we know them came back to the world. And Jerry Thomas was so far ahead of his time and such a genius and so sui generis, just doing stuff that no one else was doing that people would forget how to do and then look back to 100, 150 years later and think, holy crap, these drinks are good. These ideas are good. We can take this and we can make a world-changing industry out of it. And so a Jerry Thomas statue with Sasha Petrasky, who founded Milk and Honey, and Del DeGroff, who was the bartender who first looked at Jerry Thomas's book and decided that it was a good guide for thinking about cocktails. He's known as King Cocktail, worked at the Rainbow Room in New York for a long time. So I kind of want a trio there with Jerry Thomas at the top and then and then Petrasky and DeGroff sort of looking up to him. And then all of us can look up to the three of them and think about how wonderful they have made our lives and how delicious their drinks are.
So I will answer as follows. Today is September 11th, the 22nd anniversary of the attack on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon. And I was just surfing the Twitter this morning, as one does, and saw on Spike Cohen's account. He's the guy who ran as the vice presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party last time around. He highlighted the heroic actions on that day of Rick Rescorla, who was the head of security for Morgan Stanley, who'd been thinking on the problem of potentially evacuating the World Trade Centers ever since the early 90s. And he helped to save 2,700 lives that day, and then went back in the building to try to save more and perished. And he did so with a lot of derring do. And so hats off to Rick Rescorla and for Spike to remind us of that day. I would also throw in there Frank Kameny, a guy who fought overwhelming odds and mostly lost, but he won in the long run against the federal government's anti-gay activities in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, especially as concerns national security. Jonathan Rauch and Jamie Kirchick have both written about him at length. Please go and seek them out. And then just as a general principle, I think at every turn, except for maybe the 35th anniversary of Reason, we underrate everyone who gives us lasting works of artistic value, things that are meaningful to us personally, songwriters, film directors, whatever is your art of choice. As I get older and I can't grow a gray mustache, but if I could grow a mustache, it would be as gray as Nick's. And my sense of gratitude towards people who write or even sing one great song just it stretches on forever. There's a word for that, I know, but I forget what that is now because I'm old. All right, enough of that. Now let's get to on Friday. The Fifth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals weighed in on the Biden versus Nebraska social media jawboning case that we've talked about a time or three on this podcast, ruling unanimously that the White House, the Surgeon General, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the FBI likely violated the First Amendment by improperly influencing tech companies' decisions to remove or suppress posts having to do with COVID-19 and also elections. Peter, so much for the whole, like, you know, initial ruling by that guy in Louisiana was just crazy fever swamp stuff, huh?
Yeah. So they basically said that when the White House and the FBI and all of these federal, you know, officials who have, you know, maybe some power over how things are in America, when those folks say, hey, you really shouldn't allow some of this stuff on your platform, you should really think about that. Basically, the judges basically said, you can't do that because that's coercion, right? Like even if there is not an explicit threat, that there is an implied threat to these businesses, right? And that is not allowed that under the First Amendment. The federal government cannot be in the business of deciding which speech can be aired and which speech cannot be aired. And I think that this is it is a good ruling, and it makes clear and makes a strong case for what we have been saying, which is that yes, of course, these online platforms can moderate as they see fit. They do have the right to do so, but the federal government does not have should not be involved in interfering with or pushing these companies to either downgrade to either eliminate some of these things from their platforms or to make them very effectively inaccessible. And that is not the role of the federal government. That is not the role of the FBI. That is not the job the White House is supposed to be doing. It's really amazing the White House's response to this. which is just, the administration has promoted responsible actions to protect public health, safety, and security when confronted by challenges like a deadly pandemic and foreign attacks on our elections. Our consistent view remains that the social media platforms have a critical responsibility to take account of the effects their platforms are having on the American people, but make independent choices. Yeah, so in other words, you shouldn't let people say that, but we're not quite going to say you can't. We're just going to say you shouldn't. And when the White House says that, that's you, like the White House can't, there is an implication that the White House could and maybe will do something about in response.
Catherine, the thing that chills me even listening to Peter reading that is the number of our colleagues in the media industry who would be nodding their head saying, yeah, man, that's what the White House should have done. Are we going to start seeing, can you give me some green shoots to look at that? Maybe now that it's not just a Terry Doughty in Louisiana ruling on this, that some people in the media will like, yeah, you know what? Maybe they went a little bit too far in like telling Spotify to kick off Joe Rogan and whatnot.
Yeah, I think unfortunately we're seeing very classic, captured type behavior, right? So it's really, really hard. Policing misinformation is really hard. And figuring out where those lines are on your own is really hard. So there are going to be a lot of publications and even a lot of social media companies that are going to say, you know, if the federal government wants to make the rules, and then we can just say, it's not our problem. We're just doing what the feds told us. That's a desirable outcome for some people. Now, of course, that isn't where we are right now. Right now, we're in this horrible, back roomy, whispery, nice social media company you got there, be a shame if something happened to it vibe, which doesn't satisfy that desire, right? But I can just as easily see, instead of a kind of backlash in which people say, yeah, man, you're not our real dad, we instead get a situation where people are kind of more like, yeah, regulate me, daddy. Like, it's not good.
Nick, this is yet another federal court ruling that's been pretty strong for free speech, which we've seen at the Supreme Court level for a while. There's also three Republican-appointed judges. Are you worried that the Democratic-appointed judges might be getting wobbly on free speech, or do we think we have a pretty good backstop right now?
I think there's a pretty good backstop. Yeah. One of the things that worries me a little bit about the follow up, the ruling that you're talking about is that it actually limited the original injunction, which was much broader and covered a lot more interaction between the government and social media companies. So this one narrowed it. And it, it's basically saying that the government can't, go after protected speech and really lobby for social media companies to take it down. Before that, it was, the earlier injunction was like the government has no right or reason to be talking to social media people. This is great. It's still great news. I don't think there's any reason to believe that Democratic judges, as opposed to Democratic politicians and Democratic media journalists, pretending to be real, objective, serious, sober people, that's a different kettle of fish and it stinks. So I'm pretty happy about all of this kind of stuff. I really think the takeover, and Matt, you've written about this, obviously, Zach Weismuller and I interviewed Jacob Siegel, whose work on how misinformation and disinformation kind of framework slipped the bounds of military intelligence to be used to talk about, fucking COVID or election stuff is essential. And we'll link to the conversation that we had with him. It's unbelievable, to be as old as we are, Matt, and to see reporters go, everybody I think we knew who wanted to become a journalist became a journalist because of the, the self-propaganda that Woodward and Bernstein put out about we are telling truth to power. The government always needs to be critiqued. It's always lying to, et cetera. And now, the same kind of cohort is just a total like water carrier for the idea that certain ideas need to be restricted from even being considered in public. That's very disturbing. But the court so far pretty good.
Journalists for censorship is just the weirdest category. I'm never going to
Who saw that coming?
Wrap my brain around it. All right. I'm going to fit in a lightning round. I don't even care. Nancy Pelosi announced last week. She's
You're not afraid of us.
Yeah.
I'm not. Yes. You can't tell me what to do. Don't you jawbone me, Peter Suderman. Nancy Pelosi is running for re-election.
Yeah.
At age 5 trillion. Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, she's a run for Cthulhu's open seat in San Francisco.
Mitch McConnell is obviously doing Tharn on a pretty daily basis. For those who remember the 70s. Joe Biden, I don't know if you saw his press conference last, like they're literally like playing walk-off music. Mid answer these days for him as he says,
Matt, you are an old lying dog-faced pony boy, whatever.
What,
you know,
the living
outsider
hell. You know, John Fetterman isn't old. He's just sad and can't wear pants. I just, there's a CNN had a poll last week, a huge clump of people. I can do name the one thing that gives you pause about Joe Biden, and everyone's like, he's really old. Have you noticed? This seems to be a recurring problem, Catherine, the gerontocracy. So I give you door number one or two, A or B, or both. What's your favorite old decrepit elected official story, and or what is a proposal to make this thing stop?
I definitely don't know how to fix it, but I do have a favorite old moment, which is a classic Ted Stevens series of tubes. You may recall from 2006 when he was on the side of good, which is sometimes forgotten in the series of tubes story. He was arguing against network neutrality, and he was right to argue against network neutrality, which it turned out we didn't need. But he described the internet as being a series of tubes, and he took a lot of shit for it.
So much so that he engineered his own death shortly after. He was so embarrassed.
And I think, you know, part of the reason that it became such a thing is because he is, you know, not a spring chicken at the time that he said it. And it really just drove home in this moment that a bunch of folks who were the farthest thing you could imagine from internet natives would be making all the rules for our internets, and that might not be ideal. I will say there has been some series of tubes revisionism in later years. Like, actually, it is a series of tubes. I'm also charmed by the revisionists. So, U.S. Senator Ted Stevens in 2006, the internet is a series of tubes, and sometimes they can be filled. And when you put your message in, it gets in line, and it's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material. You're welcome.
Peter, Old's anecdote or fix?
Oh man, there was a great bit that Robbie wrote up a couple of years ago, in which there was a hearing in the House, I think it was the Senate, and one of the legislators was just like, "My iPhone doesn't work," and the guy who was there to testify was like, "Sir, I run Google," yeah. And it's just like, okay. Great folks. I'm glad that you're on top of things. That's who should be making the rules about what you can say online or, you know, do anywhere in America.
Nick, help us.
I'm going to go with sometime from the 1990s when the junior senator from South Carolina, Ernest Fritz Hollings, who was in his late 70s, but because what's his face?
Strom Thurmond.
I'm having a senior moment. Strom Thurmond, yeah. Thank you. Was the senior senator from South Carolina, but he referred to Beavis and Butthead as Buffcoat and Beaver. And he was talking about how they were destroying the country.
I watched that show.
And
that was
for, you know, years. At some point, my father, who probably was only in his 50s or maybe early 60s, kept referring to Cheech and Chong as Gooch and Gongo. And I was like, nothing will ever beat that. And then Buffcoat and Beaver came along. And sadly, I couldn't explain it to my father because he had no fucking idea. Like, what, you know, the minute I said, you know how you always call Cheech and Chong Gooch and Gongo? And he was like, what are you talking about?
And then to make it further, like to have to clarify, like, no, yeah. Beavis and Butthead are the real proper names he should, like, none of it.
Like, who, what? Yeah.
What's
like, I don't know. You know, I fought the Nazis. Yeah. It's like, yeah.
So I'll go with fix. Or it's a tentative fix because I proposed this on Twitter a couple weeks ago.
Are you
going to
have the Rolling Stones, Matt? Because it's not being old, it's being mentally old.
Correct.
You know, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Ronnie Wood are all like 80, 79, and 76, and they're out there fucking playing their asses off for several hours a night on a world tour as the Rolling Stones
and
put them in the leadership positions
and just release a new single and video and have a new album coming out. And it's not bad. The video's pretty good.
By the way, if I may, Matt, just to build up anticipation in this incredibly long lightning round, Zeus didn't have lightning rounds this long. Just the greatest thing on Instagram are the videos of Mick Jagger dancing in the studio, yes, and they take the music away and he's just kind of like chicken strutting and flapping his wings. It's what the internet, what this glorious systems of tube was built to carry.
The only thing better are the lip sync videos of all the Beach Boys songs. Just go, I Get Around, just look that up. It's the funniest thing that you'll see all year. I think that there should be, and I don't know exactly what it is, but there was a news story about Dianne Feinstein, who's still a senator. Holy cow. She's still a senator. She has no idea what's going on. Zero.
Yeah.
That, you know, that her heirs have filed for, you know, they're in charge of her. They have power of attorney over various things. This is a process that everyone goes through with their olds, if their olds are lucky enough to survive that level of certainly going through it, have gone through it with my father, beloved Pete Welch, and other people go through with their parents. You get to a level when you start, when the kids start taking over of the finances and the administration of drugs and the this is and the that. There should be a way to have that be kind of a governance red flag zone. The problem with making this effective is by then, you know, it disincentivizes people to make those rational decisions, which everyone should do 5 years before they think that they should. So I don't know exactly how to do it, but there's something in there. When you no longer are seen to have proper authority over your own functions and estate and whatnot, then that's some kind of warning sign. And we should be like investigating what we can do along those lines. All right. That was indeed the longest lightning round ever. Let's go to what we have been consuming. And let's start with Nicholas Gillespie. Yep. My God, we've seen you consume a lot at Burning Man. What happened?
Nothing happened. I mean, it rained on Friday and it turned the Playa, which I thought was a joke name, you know, playing on Spanish for beach, I guess. I don't know. What is Playa beach in Spanish? Plage, right? Is beach in French, right? I think.
Hey, Fritz Hollings, go on with the story.
Okay. So there was a lot of mud. And then because it was a slow Labor Day weekend, because, you know, nobody crapped their pants publicly, Dianne Feinstein didn't come out and say, you know, like Jim Jones was a great American who she loved when she was about to become mayor of San Francisco. So there was a lot of mud at Burning Man and the media pounced and was talking about Ebola breakouts and, you know, people starving, et cetera. And it literally had no effect on Burning Man other than it made it really muddy and kind of annoying and things like that. And it delayed people leaving by a day or two, depending on when you decided to leave. So I went to Burning Man. My consumption was Burning Man. I will paraphrase Grover Norquist, who's been going every year for about the past 10 years. Everybody should go to Burning Man at least once by the time they're 50 and then several times after they're 50. It's a fantastic 37-year-old celebration of surplus wealth that capitalism throws off like nobody's business. And it's a pay-in to both the communitarian side of voluntary affiliate of societies, as well as to the individualism of it all. And I got engaged there. So I was very
happy. Wow, way to bury the lead.
We reffed it on the beginning.
Betrothed. It's an inverted pyramid, right?
That's right.
Or a ziggurat.
It's like a German sentence. Peter, what did you consume?
I saw the Postal Service and Death Cab for Cutie touring for the 20th anniversary of two albums, the Postal Service's only full-length Give Up and Death Cab's Transatlanticism, their fourth long play, which is widely regarded as their best record. The two bands played those albums in full, just straight through. Plus, as a cover, they all came out and played an incredible rendition of Depeche Mode's Enjoy the Silence with Jenny Lewis and the Jimmy Tamborello, who is the electronic glitchcore guy who does all the music for the Postal Service, plus all of the band members from Death Cab. And of course, they share a singer, Ben Gibbard, who is the lead singer and lyricist for both acts. So this was a big moment for me. I have not seen Death Cab play since 2002. So before Transatlanticism came out, it's been over 20 years. I was a big Death Cab fan in the years before they kind of got big and blew up. Both of these bands were early internet bands that from the blog era, right? And the Postal Service in particular, they are named for that because the music was made through the mail. So there was this kind of glitchcore artist, Jimmy Tamborello, who makes music as under the moniker D'Intel, I think I'm pronouncing that correct. And he would just make beats and send them to Ben Gibbard and through the mail on CDs because they didn't know how to do file transfers back then, and Gibbard would get them a couple of days later and like listen to the music and then figure out how to sing over it, and they put together this just delightful kind of pop indie electronic record that blended a bunch of sort of dance hall early electronic glitchy things with Ben Gibbard's sort of ethereal indie rock stylings, right? And I liked these bands when I liked Death Cab in particular when they were a small band playing venues in the 500 person range. And of course, they sold out here in DC. They sold out two 3,500 person seats shows at the Anthem, and then another show at Meriwether Post Pavilion, which is even larger. But I watched over the years as Death Cab got bigger. In particular, they got huge because they were featured on the soundtrack of the show The OC, which, if you guys remember, this sort of like Beverly Hills 90210 sort of spinoff thing.
I refuse to remember that show.
Right? And it just made them gigantic. They toured with Pearl Jam. They signed to Atlantic Records. They had albums go gold. And this was like a big change for a band that had been playing very small venues. It was not selling super well. It was just kind of part of the indie college rock ecosystem of the late 90s and early aughts. And they came, like, they were part of the era that I came of musical age in, where indie bands were self-consciously opposed to becoming too popular. And they were against the idea of selling out, right? They wanted to be difficult and obscure in some ways. And I, as a teenager, was kind of on board with that. I liked the obscurity and the difficulty and the sense of, oh, I'm the only person who, it's only a few of us, the select few who know about this band. I remember, I liked bands like Joan of Arc, which was on the Jade Tree label from Chicago. And one of their songs was just them like sweeping glass off of a table as it broke while the singer kind of whined over it. It was just amazing. Still listen to it every now and then. And I'm like, yes, that's what music should be. But watching Death Cab for Cutie, which is not like that. Death Cab for Cutie is melodic and accessible, and they write songs that people can that normal people can enjoy. And watching them become huge and reach a bigger audience and then become a regular presence in the world of popular music to the point where you'd be like hear them on the background music in Starbucks, that sort of thing. Their success helped me learn to love selling out and helped me realize that actually being a big corporate band is a good thing. Sales and popularity are obviously not the only thing that matters in the world, but being popular and successful is good for artists and it's good for fans, and more artists should aspire to sell out.
Catherine, what did you consume?
I read the novel American Genius, a comedy by Lynn Tillman. It's the vibes are similar to Otessa Moshfegha's work, which I've recommended here in the past, this sort of hyper-scrutinized, super detail-oriented, memoirish, moody writing. And it came out in 2019.
Are there like a lot of body parts?
There are body parts. So in fact, the book is framed by the author's very sensitive skin. And the thing that is interesting about this book is that it, of course, uses that to talk about a bunch of stuff, but also just kind of like, why we're all so sensitive? Why are we all so touchy? Why are we all breaking out in hives, literally and metaphorically, all the time with each other? It's good. It's a good book. It came out in 2019. There's no reason you would be reading it or anyone will be talking about it, but I did, so you could too. American Genius, a comedy by Lynn Tillman.
So my 8-year-old is going deep into the sort of post or mid Lord of the Rings kind of like, hey, I want to go to the Renaissance Fair. Like, it's on. She would, if it was up to
can
her,
I
she'd
take
be going.
Her? Can we
go into the, you can, you would be more enthusiastic than her mother will be since I'll be in California that day. And it's going to be hilarious for everybody. I've been trying to think like, okay, so what do we do? Like, how do I get something that's outside of this? And I was racking my brain. I'm like, oh yeah, let's watch Time Bandits, right? This is a Terry Gilliam 1981 kids picture of a kid who gets caught up with a bunch with a half a dozen dwarves, obviously, who are have a special map that takes them through various times in history because they're trying to steal stuff, and hijinks ensue. And I thought I remembered this movie. I remember like watching it at the time, thinking, yeah, it was good. You know, they wore costumes and there's John Cleese's Robin Hood, you know, and Sean Connery.
George Harrison, closing credit ballad.
Yep. Like with bad sort of electronica sheen on it. Yeah. It's a Handmade Films picture, George Harrison's movie company. And it was a big hit at the time. And I remember really liking it. And man, did I not remember anything, because that movie is weird. That movie is weird. That's like Fellows is going to look at that movie.
Isn't it a little like breaking news, a Terry Gilliam movie is weird like that?
Well, you didn't know it at the time.
You didn't know it at the time.
It was his directing debut.
We know it in 2023, artist. Right? No. Okay.
But it's like, it's true. Not just weird in like the Brazil, oh God, Terry Gilliam's kind of a strange person. It's weird, like, you know how when you watch an old movie that you loved a lot in the 70s or 80s and you go, wow, that's slow. That's just, they could have put a little cut there.
I don't think part of me made it out of that fucking Napoleon sequence, man. I think it's still going on, quite honest.
That Napoleon sequence is so slow. Hurry it up. Just like the beats and the rhythm were all strange, but not just that. Like at the end, and spoiler alert, close your ears. But like just kind of randomly and apropos of nothing, the parents are murdered in the last moment as Sean Connery sort of waves as a fireman at the end. The whole thing is just weird. It's an interesting artifact. Check it out. There are moments that I guess I remembered only one thing, which is the kid and the ogre, and saying let to what he needs to make himself happy is some stretching. Cause I can recognize that in my own life, more stretching, less back pain. That's all of the stretching and back pain we have time for in this non-lightning round of a podcast. Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. And you should also sign up for our New York City newsletter stuff, because Nick Gillespie and Dr. Gene, the Disco King Epstein, also.
He's only got a master's, man.
He has the Welsh doctorate, honorary Welsh doctorate, which means a lot more in
which
this
means,
kingdom.
Three semesters of college. You get a doctorate.
What's happening in New York going forward, Mr. Gillespie?
Okay, so do sign up for the New York City newsletter. We'll put a link in the show notes. That's where everything is listed, or you'll get an email about it. On 9/18, September 18th, the Soho Forum features Brian Kaplan, George Mason economist, versus Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute, talking about anarcho-capitalism or anarchism. That should be a great debate. On the 20th, I'm moderating an open-to-debate between Michael Ian Black, the guy who was the Pets.com mascot way back when, and Lou Perez about whether or not wokeness killed comedy. And then on September 26th, we have the next Reason Speakeasy with Yasha Monk, somebody who Matt has talked to multiple times on his other podcast, The Fifth Column. We'll be talking to him about his fabulous new book called The Identity Trap, which is about how identity politics are a dead end.
Beautiful. Thank you all for listening. If you like what we do, please consider making a tax-deductible donation, reason.com/donate. And otherwise, we will see you next week. Goodbye.